Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1076.EZ2613, certificate number 31616. The Rite of Spring Riot.
Up until this point, the post-human listeners of the distant future have not heard us mention one of our favorite things, the art of ballet.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Rite of Spring, which I always associate with heavy petting.
Is that's your Rite of Spring?
Yeah. Heavy petting. It's the season of heavy petting.
My Rite of Spring is like replacing all my sprinkler heads. We have a very different lifestyle.
But ballet, you're absolutely right. One of the preeminent human accomplishments.
Pretty much the great human accomplishment.
Yeah.
It's all led to this point.
It's our highest form.
But we have not mentioned it on the show at all, I believe. So It's funny to imagine all these cuttlefish people,
right,
who know everything about government cheese, but have no idea we also did ballet.
Have no idea that we perfected being human.
So just so you guys know, we did ballet. It went fine.
Not us personally.
John and I did ballet. We were taking classes now. What is your experience with the ballet? You have a little diaphanous little daughter. Does she do ballet?
She tried, but I think she's too stout to have a career in ballet.
Right.
And so I figured let's eliminate the later disappointment by redirecting that energy to something else. Modern dance.
Katie's doing tap right now.
Kickboxing.
Tap's fun.
Tap is fun. And we do tap around the house.
Just not even for
just
lessons?
Like, because I show her YouTube videos of Shirley Temple movies and various, like, we follow the tap.
That explains a lot. Do you feel like you've kind of molded your daughter by the curly top clips you've shown her?
But when I was younger, when I was 17... when I was in my 20s, you know, here we have, here in Seattle, we have the Cornish College of the Arts, which had a ballet program. And during that period, I lived in the...
Yeah, you lived nearby.
I lived in the artistic neighborhood around artistic people.
You had an artistic loft of some kind.
I did. I was an artistic person myself. And so I dated several ballerinas over the course of a compressed amount of time.
You're a serial ballerina dater?
I had to ask myself at some point, do you have a ballerina problem? And, you know, eventually I just sort of moved away from the ballerina years.
A dark chapter for you.
But I learned a lot about dance and about the trials and tribulations of standing on point.
Yeah, talk to any ballet dancer and you'll just hear how awful it is. I mean, the idea is to look graceful and comfortable while doing the most unnatural, uncomfortable things.
But the whole ballet culture, I mean, they become very body obsessed and and like compulsive workouts. And I had one of my very closest ballet friends, let's say ballet friend, she would dance all day, then run to Lake Washington from Capitol Hill, jump in the lake, swim out to the buoy or whatever, swim back.
Any time of year?
Yep. And then run back up to Capitol Hill.
That's
and,
that Russian influence in the ballet still.
And then she would teach yoga then at the end of the day. And I'm like, look, like, sweetheart, we need to go to the movies sometimes too. Like we have to take a break from exhausting ourselves. And she was like, I'm fine. Ah!
Yeah, ballet is just a way to propagate eating disorders. It's not the other way around.
Yeah, and like compulsive work, like self-flagellation, like you're saying, the Russian model of just like punish yourself to get better.
Like the fact that there's, can you imagine if we were podcasting and all the time in front of a big mirror? You might like it, actually.
Well, do you think we should? I mean, when I look across the table at you, I see a mirror image of me.
Am I doing all your expressions? No, but ballet. Hey,
are those my expressions?
Yes, this is my big jovial John Roderick affect. Hey, come in. I'm expensive. Do you ever say that? Do you ever say I'm expensive to people?
Expansive or expensive?
Expansive with an A. You're not that expensive.
Well, maybe if I said, come in, I'm expensive.
Come in, I'm expensive.
My life would improve.
Is that what you say when you walk into Value Village? Or?
No, but I should when I go into like City Hall. I should walk into all those city council meetings and say, I'm expensive.
This should be you coming into the venue like for a big show.
Hello.
I'm the headliner. I'm expensive. Thanks, everybody. We've been expensive. Good night. But ballet is something you do in front of a big mirror.
Right.
The point being that you can see every little imperfection in every angle.
Right.
And I don't know if it attracts that kind of personality or it adds to it, but that's also been my experience with the dance people I know.
My sense is that that sort of like super competitive tumbling or... like Olympic level
gymnastics or super what if they just renamed gymnastics super competitive tumbling?
Super competitive tumbling.
We got a great SCT finals tonight, Bob Costas.
But like those things, at a certain point, even more than other competitive sports, there's just no room for error or any like. You just have to be born to do it in a way. Born and then relentlessly trained for your whole life.
We have a friend whose daughter dances ballet, like good enough to, she's danced with Pacific Northwest Ballet. I think nobody just ever sees her. She has the busiest life.
Right.
Because that's what you do.
But you'd also have to be, I mean, I could never have done it, no matter what I did.
You don't have the legs for it?
I just don't have or whatever the build is. Like you could have the perfect build. And just not have the eye of the tiger.
There's certainly a kind of cult about it. I mean, my impression from not knowing anything about the world of ballet is that it's the people love the purity and the rigor of it. You know, it's a real simplicity. Like we've perfected dance in these five positions, and this is as good as dance gets now. We're going to wear the simplest possible costumes and do these like. Series of very simple moves, but we're just going to do them the absolute best and most fluidly you've ever seen them done. And a small cult of people is going to recognize that. It's not for, you know, if you're a newbie, go to modern dance, go see something with a little more spectacle and surprise and suspense. Like when I see when Trey McIntyre's dance guys come through town, do you ever see any modern dance?
Yeah. Well,
I feel like I get it. I'm like, yeah, look at these people doing this crazy thing. There's just so much going on. It's like a circus.
Modern dance utilizes a lot of ballet. And I imagine it's because there are a lot of ballerinas that are like, okay, I got to get off this crazy train.
Well, I think it's also because ballet is just like the fundamentals,
right.
You know, like we don't ever try anything crazy. We just do this tiny group of things in our tutus.
But I really enjoy modern dance. I think, some of those shows they just connect with you emotionally.
It kind of mixes like what you get out of athletics, like watching somebody do some amazing high hurdles run feeling like you've seen some artistic creative exploration you've never seen before. It's not that different from speed skating, I guess, or super competitive tumbling.
What's crazy?
I said speed skating, but I meant figure skating. You knew what I meant.
Yeah. Speed skating doesn't move me
I couldn't really follow the narrative there. Were you trying to get to the end of the track faster than the finish guy?
Around and around. But the analog of, or like the, I guess the companion art of super competitive tumbling or gymnastics, as we say, like Simone Biles, I will watch her her performances on YouTube and, you know, and get choked up. And it is not, what's interesting is it's not the weird tacked on dance moves that they put in those.
Like, you know, she gets to the end of a run and then she does some little, hey.
Some like, huzzah, bazzah, bazzah, and then she does like these crazy moves.
I'm a little embarrassed actually during the little dance breaks. Yeah. I'm like, oh, come on.
Me too. But but it's just the pure physicality.
Yes.
And her strength and her just, I mean, the way that she tumbles is in and of itself, it feels very artistic. It moves me artistic.
And you don't get it from watching a kickoff return. Like, it's not just the fact that you're seeing some, you know, the human body doing the absolute best it can do at a thing. There's something beyond that, just the fluidity of the fact that the motion is choreographed in a way.
Yeah, right. I mean, when Michael Jordan would fly through the air with his tongue out and put the basketball in the thing behind his head.
It's great.
I would go like, yeah, but I never like cried.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm.
Sometimes if you were like a Western Conference fan, if you were a Sonics or a Jazz fan, you might cry.
Yeah, Lakers but fan. Don't those people like teach themselves not to cry at a young age when they're like hitting each other with hockey sticks or whatever?
Sports has so much failure in it. Like your team's hardly ever going to win. That's my theory of sports. Anyway, like, so the purity of ballet and kind of the rigor of it is really one of the things at the core of the story of what happened on the night of May 29th, 1913.
Oh.
Which even if you... Well, you're amazed by that segue?
Yeah. I was just like, oh, we're going to go down to a granular level here.
Do you have any other broader points about the ballet?
No, I was having a good time explaining to the crustaceans, the crustaceans with ears that listen to our show about just, you know, talking generally about dance, but we're going to talk about an event.
It's probably the most famous events maybe in any kind of modern art of the early 20th century, and it's not always remembered accurately or contextualized.
Was it a massacre? Right?
It was kind of a massacre. Mm. It was a massacre of taste and in some accounts of actual human flesh. The ballet, the Stravinsky Ballet Rite of Spring is called Le Sacre de Printemps in French,
the heart of spring.
Yeah, no, not
the
not
blood court. Of spring.
It's S-A-C-R-E. It's like the
sacred.
The, yeah, I guess right. The ritual of spring or something. There's another word in Russian. I think it means the coronation of spring.
Oh, so spring is personified.
Maybe it's not. Maybe it's like the coronation that happens during spring. Maybe. I don't know. But the point is that there's often a pun made between sacra, meaning ritual, and massacre. You know, they would call it Le Massacre de Printemps, the riot of spring. Hey, the pun works in English.
That's nice. The riot of spring.
It would be the riot of spring.
And they did that as a form of criticizing the ballet?
It's what happened after the unusual events in the audience that night. This was a night out at the ballet where what was happening offstage was much more interesting than what's happening on. And this is true of me whenever I go to the Nutcracker. I'm like much more interested in just whatever's happening around me than any of the dances.
Is it what happened in the audience, was it inflamed by what was happening on stage or unrelated?
So there are the firsthand accounts of the event differ very much. And later accounts tend to romanticize or mythologize the event, or people claiming they were there who weren't, or people they were there for, who were there for the premiere who were not. So it appears, and everybody has a theory, and it appears to be a mixture of things, you know, just that whatever that weird alchemy that has to happen to turn a bunch of people into a crowd, whether they're, you know, cheerfully singing in some good cause,
right,
or whether they're, you know, putting...
they turn against a comedian.
Right, heckling a comedian, or putting traffic barricades through car windshields,
right,
or lighting garbage cans on fire. I mean,
spontaneously dancing in a mall because they read about it on the internet.
Flash mobs. Yeah, this appears to have been a flash mob, some kind of a planned protest. But that's not the entirety of what happened. This was the first time that Rite of Spring, the great Stravinsky ballet, had ever been performed. It took place in Paris at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, a brand new, just beautiful, deluxe theater done in some kind of over-the-top...
Art Nouveau style.
I think it was kind of German-looking, but it was, you know, the fanciest place to do ballet. But the resident troupe there was not French. It was the Ballet Russe, of the great ballet impresario Sergei Diaghilev. He had set up shop with a bunch of these Russian emigres in Paris, you know, a world dance capital.
This is prior to the revolution, but...
Just prior.
Yeah.
Just a few years. And there's already been a massive wave of Russian emigres and expatriates coming west into Europe, maybe for political reasons, but maybe just to get to Paris where all the action is.
Well, and you know, Peter the Great encouraged his aristocratic class in Russia to all learn French as part of his modernization of Russia that happened when he made all the monks cut their sleeves and whatnot.
And wear berets.
Yeah.
Remember when all the monks had to wear berets?
He was like, look, we're part of Europe. We are not part of Slobovistan.
He like, he slaps this borscht out of somebody's hand. Pick up a baguette, damn it.
That's right.
It's kind of an interesting time here because what's happening in St. Petersburg, of course, is that the French aesthetic is the highest possible thing. Everyone's speaking French and trying to paint like the French. Whereas in Paris, the cool new thing for all the young boho types is Russian art and language.
Interesting.
So each capital is like the respective cultural capital of the other's best stuff, which is really weird and hard to imagine today given what Russia has become in our time.
But that was Fabergé eggs era? Mm-hmm. That was...
It would have been like, I guess a little early for Chagall, but...
But that would have been like, for instance...
it's great.
Joseph Conrad was sort of writing, but I guess he's not in Paris exactly.
Polish, but he emigrated to London. It was right. The same kind of thing.
Right.
He brought whatever the deeply felt Slavic roots, and that was just something that Western Europe really responded to. Mm. You know, it's novelty. And this is a time when... we're going to get to this, but where the arts are looking beyond, you know, twee Victorian, a certain kind of very limited Westernness. You know, what people like is when Paul Gauguin goes to Tahiti or Picasso gets really into African masks and other cultures are the hip new thing.
Right.
And there's
exoticism.
There's some level of orientalizing going on there, but I mean, you know, what's worse, to not know African art at all,
right?
Or to like kind of
fetishize it?
Yeah, to fetishize it.
I feel like I can live with the orientalization of the Russians. It feels like, you know, I'll let that pass.
This is going back to the reindeer wizards. We have a friend who does a lot of directing the local school musicals, just in the Seattle Public Schools here. It's kind of her passion, and she does it every year. And at some local school, she was trying to do, she found a great version of Aladdin she wanted to do. And I think the principal and the school board told her, no, you can't do Aladdin. And she said, why? And he's like, well, it would be just a bunch of white kids in harem pants. You know, it's a bad look.
Right.
Like do something, you know, do something that doesn't feel like appropriation.
He obviously wasn't in the alternative culture in the early 90s because it was all just white kids in harem pants.
Yeah, I still have my hammer pants at the back of my closet. I'm ready if hammer time ever comes back.
It's coming.
I take my kids to the closet and I say, kids, these are daddy's parachute pants. You can't touch this.
Do-do-do.
And they don't.
They don't.
But that, it was kind of the same dilemma, like because she told them, you know, if this is the rule... I mean, she's not trying to do Raisin in the Sun in blackface. She's just right. trying to do a children's fantasy of Aladdin
right.
with little blonde kids and was told that's a bad look. And she's like, look, then all we can do is like all white European art. Like what you've said is our public schools can only have white European art. And they're like, yeah, you know.
Oops-a-daisy.
Catch 22. But it's the same kind of thing. Would you rather have Europe thinking that... Asian or Tahitian art is not a thing? Or would you rather them kind of getting a little too creepily into it?
Well, your kids were in our town, as they now do every year,
yes,
right?
Every
just our town every year. Guys and Dolls.
They do Sound of Music every year because yeah. there's a lot of little kids in Seattle that look like Hitler Youth. So it's perfect. But accounts differ of what actually happened in the stands of the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées that night. There, in almost every account, there yelling starts almost immediately when the curtain comes up on the ballet. This quickly turns, you don't hear yelling much at the ballet?
I mean,
you seem surprised.
Just generally, like halfway through a show, sometimes I'll stand up and say,
this rules.
Do you want to go out with me?
Hey, water lily number 6, not you, next to you, with the bun.
No, I'm not accustomed to riots breaking out at ballets, but you know, appreciation of the arts has dimmed in our time.
Yeah, nobody cares enough.
Yeah.
People are just looking at their watch to see if they'll make their dinner reservation.
What was the scandal or what was the conflict?
Again, it's hard to say. It escalates into fistfights, stampedes. It appears to be a conflict between different factions of the crowd, which is interesting. A woman takes a long hat pin out of her elaborate hat and stabs the man next to her.
Oh, this is just a Russian assassination scenario.
It's got polonium on it. In some accounts, the man she stabs is the poet and playwright Jean Cocteau. But this is the kind of thing where that's the thing I'm least likely to believe is that some local celebrity is claiming to have been the one that it happened to.
Right. And then Harry Houdini appeared.
And then Mark Wahlberg could have been there to stop the riot, but he took a different liner. Like in the end, what's sure is that there are other funny accounts. Somebody in the orchestra says he saw many a gentleman's shiny top hat or soft fedora was pulled down by an opponent over his eyes and ears.
What were people doing wearing their top hats after the curtain had come up?
Maybe that's why somebody pulled it down. Could you get this lower on your head? I can't quite see that.
All of these accounts start to seem a little bit questionable. Nobody's wearing their top hat during the show.
So people are brandishing canes. In some account, they're challenging each other to duels.
In 1913?
In 1913.
Who was dueling in the middle of the 1913?
Opera. Well, also, how does it come up? Like, the orchestra presumably is playing very loudly. How do you get all the arrangements? People are comparing it to an earthquake. The writer Von Vechten says that the man behind him is so wrapped up in all the general craziness that he just starts pounding on the back of Von Vechten's hat, like, bum, 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 bum. Like, he uses the guy ahead of him as a drum and doesn't even realize he's doing it. Which I go to the movies all the time, and even when I'm very into Get Out or whatever, I never do that.
You don't sit in.
Just drum on the head of the bald man in front of me. Oh, sorry. I just love Star Wars. Sorry. It's just Tony Stark was. Oh no.
The thing is, we complain about having lost so much in the passage of time. Everybody now at the ballet is just wearing a flannel shirt and like chewing tobacco. But one thing we also I think people make the pretty good point that we've also lost a lot of inequality along the way, and we've also lost head drumming and like being challenged to duels at the theater, which I think is progress.
Well, issues of class and dress in the theater this very night do indeed play into this. Uh-huh. But we should say, first of all, you're not exaggerating. Seattle is a city where people will wear flannel to the opera.
It's very expensive flannel, though. That's what confuses people, because if you challenge the guy and say, why are you wearing flannel? He'll say, oh, it's silk flannel made, you know, like that was
this that, is a,
that
vintage.
A civet ate and then pooped out. And yeah, I mean, it's everyone in Seattle could be a billionaire. That's why you have to tiptoe around the dress code.
The noise is getting so loud in the theater that that the dancers can't hear the time. And so Stravinsky has to run back to the wings and just start yelling at the dancers, you know, start counting at the dancers.
He didn't stop the show?
No. He immediately sees what's happening and runs backstage to try to keep it going. But the show must go on, John, as you know, in the performing arts.
Wow.
I mean, they do. So the theater does end up kicking out 40 people. And in many accounts, police are called, although it's hard to corroborate.
Did someone set off a fire extinguisher?
And by the next week, it's in the New York Times. The headline in the New York Times says, Parisians hiss new ballet. Russian dancer's latest offering, a failure, has to turn up lights. Manager of theater takes this means to stop hostile demonstrations as dance goes on.
So it was about the show. From the curtain goes up, the first dancers arrive on the stage, and it's scandalous.
People are immediately mad. Some people came mad. Some people quickly became mad when they saw the staging, and then everybody got wrapped up into it. And let's go into some of the reasons why.
Is Stravinsky himself a divisive choreographer?
Stravinsky's very new on the scene. He is just coming off The Firebird and Petrushka, the two of the biggest hits in the ballet world.
I guess he was the composer, not the not the
he's dance. He's not the choreographer. Right. He wrote the music. The choreographer was by Vasily Nijinsky, who I think is also dancing the lead for Diaghilev this night. But Stravinsky is the one backstage. He knows the music, so he's trying to yell the count to the dancers. Oh, and a funny thing about that is that in Russian, all the numbers very quickly become polysyllabic. So it's not really a 1, 2, 3, 4. Right. You know, he's having to be like, you know, and it doesn't lend itself to to yelling at dancers as shoes are getting thrown at them, I guess. But so he's the biggest new thing. Diaghilev has plucked him from obscurity because Diaghilev wants to produce modern forward-thinking ballet, and here's this new young guy. And even before he writes Firebird and Petrushka, he is thinking about a ballet based on the pagan rituals of his Russian ancestry, you know, the spring fertility stuff that seems very potent and ready for the dance, right?
It does. And this is an era of more libertine arts. So maybe people are ready for a little bit of paganism.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of libertinism, Nijinsky has just danced the lead in Debussy's Afternoon of the Faun. And one of the new positions he added to the ballet vocabulary when he did that was he mimed, touching himself in his dance belt area on the stage. And so there's kind of a graphic...
dance belt touching.
The Afternoon of the Faun includes a little me time for the Faun.
And that is... you're saying that that's now part of the ballet lexicon? You can use that in any ballet?
Yeah, you can just do it in the middle of...
Nutcracker?
Middle of the Nutcracker, yeah. You can... you don't want to crack them.
No.
So that's kind of a tension that's going on, is that, you know, these young Turks, they're not literally Turks, but they're from someplace almost as bad, Slavic places, are, you know, in the eyes of a Parisian,
sure.
Not to us.
No.
John and I, of course, agree that all cultures are exactly equal and good and valid. Yes,
all people are the same.
But that was not the general opinion in the Paris art scene.
So this was at a time when, and I think we see this all the time in the arts, right? Where a form keeps evolving until it is evolving past where the audience wants to see the form evolve. We see it in rock and roll, right? Where
Dylan goes electric.
Yeah.
That's not folk anymore.
And speed metal turns to death metal. And pretty soon it has to break off because the people that adored it at first can no longer handle the deviation. And I think ballet and classical music were still the dominant modes, and there wasn't yet there wasn't jazz yet, really.
Right.
And so this was in this transition. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, and let's talk about the music, because I think most retellings of this night really emphasize that the music was so avant-garde that this just changed, the audience freaked out, and this is the watershed moment that changes the course of 20th century music. That's what Leonard Bernstein was always saying. Because you did have composers like Debussy and Ravel that were kind of playing with different kinds of, you know, music that was more impressionistic and was about rhythm instead of, you know, kind of the mathematical perfection of how a lot of classical music worked, you know, Baroque music or then the romanticism of a Beethoven, for example. But Rite of Spring is notably harsh. Like it, the first thing you hear is a sound you've really never heard. It sounds like maybe the oboist is having a stroke or something. It's really somebody is playing the bassoon, but too high. Like at the height of its range.
It's screeching.
It's a solo bassoon kind of screeching. And it's the effect you get when you like take a Casio and you're like, I wonder what the piccolo sounds like, you know, two octaves below middle C. You know, the bassoon is not meant to sound like that.
Right.
And then as the piece goes on, the instrumentation continues to be very discordant. The woodwinds kind of twitter and the brass really shrieks. It really feels like it's yelling at you. And the whole thing is very driven by percussion.
This isn't, I mean... Like shortly after this, the idea of 12-tone music starts to revolutionize, I guess, music theory.
Well, that's the thing.
Compositional theory.
There's all this weird stuff going on in this piece, which you know, I can outline for you. But the avant-garde, the newness of it is kind of overblown now a century later, because as you say, like the great composers of atonality and 12-tone system had already started working. Schoenberg's early work had come out. Webern had done his six pieces for orchestra.
Like, so this was scandalous in tone, but in form, it was still based. It was actually in a traditional world.
If you listen to it today, if you listen to Rite of Spring today, you will think, "Boy, this is some crazy classical music." But you will think, "Yeah, this is classical music."
Right.
You will not think, "What has happened to the canon?"
Right.
And even at the time, what I'm saying is this is less experimental than what a lot of these Bohemian folks would have been hearing when they go hear Schoenberg and Weber and say, "This is the new thing." You know, just because there is some experimentation. You know, there's in one movement called the Ritual of the Rival Tribes, the music is played at two speeds at once in a 3-to-2 ratio.
Oh, that's perfect. I love polyrhythms.
There's your kind of, you know, speed
metal
thing.
I use that in the song Cinnamon, the Long Winter song Cinnamon. In Cinnamon, you have the drums are playing in 4/4 time, and the band is playing in 3/4 time.
Did you get it from Stravinsky?
No, I developed it by accident.
Can you imagine telling your bandmates, "No, I want to try this Stravinsky thing," and they're all like, yeah, dude. Man, right on.
No, it was somebody was doing one thing, and I started doing another thing, and I was like, that's cool, let's record it.
I've heard that song so many times, and I've never noticed that the drum thing sounds kind of a little off-kilter.
Yeah, it only catches up with itself
every 12. The lowest common denominator. See, my daughter says she'll never need lowest common denominator. And I need to say, what if you're a drummer, honey? What if all our dreams come true and you become a drummer?
Yeah, what if you're playing an 11/17 time? You better know. But Schoenberg wasn't doing ballet.
Right. So this is the kind of thing you would go to at a concert hall and maybe applaud the composer's bravery.
Yeah, go and do it because it's difficult.
But a bunch of people at the ballet are expecting ballet to observe these fundamental rules of ballet, and when they hear an 11/4 bar that's all bass drum or a semi-quaver upbeat, or there's one particular movement called the sacrificial dance where Stravinsky could play it but spent months trying to notate it because he could hear it in his head, but it was so complicated, he couldn't actually get the orchestration on paper.
Right.
I guess the opposite of the John Cage thing, where he could write it down, but never expected anybody to play it.
Yeah, it's like Zappa's Black Page.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's not what you expect to hear at the ballet. And especially at the time when the French tradition is classicism and romanticism. And then Stravinsky is very definitely playing the notes you don't expect, in the combinations you don't expect. It's just a lot of dissonance and discord, and it's perfect for the theme of a crazy Slavonic fertility ritual.
Right.
Which I guess I've never said the plot of the ballet. Which who cares, right?
Well, I've been to a lot of ballets, and I never understood the plot of anyone.
My daughter got so furious at the Nutcracker. She got all dolled up in her Christmas best, and you know, it starts with the big Christmas tree, and Clara gets the Nutcracker, and there's this intrigue with the Mouse King, and then they go away to a fantasy world, and her little eyes are gleaming. And I don't know if you've ever seen the Nutcracker, but the second act, there is no plot. It's just a series of dances.
Yeah.
They get to the fantasy's Christmas kingdom, and then they're like, hey, let's watch an Arabian dance. Ooh, now let's watch a Chinese dance. Now let's watch the Sugar Plum Fairies dance.
I struggled even to understand the plot of Tosca, but like I went to a year or two ago, I was seeing a young woman who asked me if I had ever been to, or no, she assumed I had seen The Phantom of the Opera. And I had to confess, I'd never seen The Phantom of the Opera, and I had never been to a musical on Broadway. I'd never seen a musical, I don't think.
You'd never seen?
I think I performed in Side by Side by Sondheim.
Do you still know any of the music? Can you do a little bit for us?
I don't think I have it ready at hand. But we were in New York, and she said, I got us tickets to see The Phantom of the Opera. And I was like, wow, I'm finally going to see this legendary show. And I went and sat sort of, you know, like, was she, but they were good seats. And I was like, The Phantom of the Opera, here we go. The Phantom, he comes out and he's lurking in the bell tower, or whatever he does.
Masks, and I don't think he's under the opera.
Under the opera.
He's not above the opera.
And, none of us are above the opera. But I watched the whole show, and I was just like almost completely unmoved. The plot seemed to be a very, very thin sort of, screen put over the top of some okay songs. There were a couple that were...
There's some catchy...
You know, the Masquerade... Song?
Masquerade.
That was pretty fun.
We are having masquerades. Masquerade.
People marched around the stage, but I walked out and I was like, that's one of the biggest musicals of all time? Is this really what... there's a reason I haven't seen these.
I like how you came into being as a Broadway snob.
Yeah, immediately.
Like, you're like, hey, I've done Sondheim, baby. I'm not watching this crap.
I watched all... My dad took me to see All That Jazz in 1978, which was too early.
I'm a Bob Fosse kid. It's great. You don't know anything about Broadway and you're already a Broadway snob.
Well, you know what? I'll be a snob about anything.
That's the way to be. Yeah. My daughter actually turned out to be a huge musicals fan, and I think that Nutcracker moment was very formative for her. She did not just want music and dance. She was like, what happened to the story?
I see.
Where are the numbers?
Yes.
The numbers in Rite of Spring are pretty simple. The whole first act is a bunch of people do a bunch of different crazy springtime rites.
Like sex. They sex each other.
They don't do Afternoon of a Fawn, but it's very...
What are they doing? Gathering water from the well? What's the euphemism? Is a train going into a tunnel?
Yes, it's a train going into a tunnel. Spring is here.
Let's take a train trip.
It's just that they're waving their arms and there's a lot of flailing, basically.
Yeah, that's what I do every spring. You come out of your cocoon and wave your arms.
I mean, we should be clear that I think it's a lot easier to see near naked bodies now, so we underappreciate how much of the appeal of ballet was that rich leotards. Swells got to go see people in shape, very attractive people in good shape wearing leotards. Yeah,
right.
Like this is it's very sexy. They're lifting each other up. Yes. You know, very little is left to the imagination. Today, the ballet seems extremely chaste.
Yes. Although every once in a while,
not to you apparently with your with your seven straight girlfriends, you're a balletto man.
Yeah, I mean those that you know because you see the lifting and the
splaying. Yeah, there's a lot of splaying.
There is. There's a certain amount of you being able to hold your body in unusual positions.
It raises quite a few questions.
It does.
It doesn't beg them.
No. It does not beg them.
But in your mind, in the audience, it raises them.
It suggests.
It's very suggestive.
It suggests opportunities. Really.
Wink, wink. Nudge, nudge. And then the second act, after the intermission, there's a little more plot-driven. A sacrificial virgin gets chosen.
Okay.
So there can't be too much going on in Act 1 because there's still a virgin in Act 2.
Okay.
And she's the one
at least one of them.
And she's the one who has to sacrifice herself to Spring, and she basically dances herself to death.
Huh. So sacrifices herself to Spring.
Yeah. Spring needs a virgin.
Uh-huh.
Spring needs blood. So part of the rite is that someone's got to die, but she doesn't get stabbed on an altar. It's told through ballet. So she gets so carried away that the dance herself, her own, fertile, the fire of spring in her blood is what eventually takes her out.
Yeah. It's sort of Sabine enthusiasm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nobody's capturing her. She's self-captured.
Persephone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so spring comes because Hades captured, we often say raped, although not in the modern sense.
Right.
Maybe in the modern sense.
Ravished.
A goddess, a fertility goddess, and took her away. And I guess that's what's being played into here. But not in a Greek mode, in a Slavic mode for sure.
Right. Although the Slavs considered themselves the inheritors of the Greek.
Hey, we've got backwards N's and R's, they would say. Like, do you guys have backwards N's and R's? Stravinsky like kind of locked himself into a room in Switzerland, a tiny little room with just a piano, and went nuts for months making these melodies with this idea he'd had in his head of ancient Russian fertility rhythms. And I guess his resource here was a folklorist named Nikolai Rerich, I think, who is such an interesting figure that I think he will be his own omnibus entry at some point. So CF Nikolai Rerich.
This is, talking about taboo rhythms here.
These are, yeah, it's not, it doesn't have the, within 10 years, there would be a seal of African approval, mm-hmm. These are coming from the jungle. These are the authentic rhythms of a different land and a mysterious people.
Right.
And it's the same appeal here. It's a different land and a mysterious people, but the people are Bulgarians, basically.
You don't think of the rhythms of Belarus.
No, can you imagine the Belarusians today saying, we invented jazz? But Rerich is one of he's a folklorist, he's an archaeologist, he's a painter of historical Russian scenes and trying to, reimagine Russia's artistic legacy and heritage without any kind of Peter the Great foreign influence. And the end of his story is fascinating in that it almost brings down FDR's vice president. There's an alternate universe in which Wendell Willkie wins the 1940 election because of a Nikolai Rerich scandal. And I'm not going to get into it now, but I think that's a pretty good omnibus candidate.
Save that for the future.
So Rerich designs the costumes for this and the staging for this ballet, the scenery, I guess you would say. So as the curtain comes up, people are not wearing the wispy diaphanous leotards and tutus you would expect.
Boo!
They're wearing what looks like kind of baggy animal skins.
Boo!
Everybody's got pants. Like if you were told that it was an attempt at kind of Native American fashion, you would believe it, actually. It's jerkins and whatnot.
This is making me want to pound a guy's hat.
The dancers do not have buns. They have the opposite of buns, which are like long kind of braids. Like so they're wearing maybe wigs.
They have Brunhilde hair.
They've got kind of long Brunhilde hair. And instead of you would expect maybe the language of ballet with a few nods to you know, rural peasant dance. And I think that's what the audience is expecting. And that's not what they see at all. Nothing that is happening is graceful or sexy in any way.
Yeah. I mean, I could see the ballerinas being dressed like Halloween sexy tiger or whatever, but not if they're going to be like rutting around.
Yeah. They're literally kind of jerking their limbs. They're stomping. There's one movement called Augurs of Spring, which is just basically based on them just kind of stamping on the ground and throwing themselves at the ground.
So it's modern dance.
It's kind of modern dance. And the aesthetic of ballet is very aerial. It's upward. You know, it's how can we slip the surly bonds of Earth? You know, like, let's pretend there's no gravity and this is super easy.
Whoops, there goes gravity.
And instead, as Cocteau said, these people see knock-kneed and long-braided Lolitas doing this kind of bestial thing. You see, maybe you're more interested than they were in long braided Lolitas.
I mean,
do they have to be knock-kneed for you?
Well, it helps. I can't go on record as being pro Lolita, though.
Nijinsky did this on purpose. He wrote, "I detest Nightingale and prose poetry." I guess all the fripperies of romanticism are not his bag. He says, "I eat my meat without sauce béarnaise." That's his big artistic statement.
I don't need mayonnaise on my steak.
Yeah, this is like you getting your chicken fried steak on the road. Yeah. Like, I'm that kind of a guy.
Yeah, extra meat for a dollar, he says.
And he drilled these guys for just 120 hours and told them, you know, no facial expressions whatsoever. We want the audience to feel nothing. You guys should look impassive. Even when the chosen maiden throws herself off the, you know, whatever her death is, her face is totally calm, but she has what looks like a medical seizure, she's having an episode.
I've been to a lot of dances influenced by this.
Somebody in the balcony apparently yelled "Un docteur" because she thought she was really in trouble. And some other wag, because the audience is out of control this time, some other wag says "Un dentiste."
He's my guy.
Tag yourself. I'm undentist. Somebody else says "deux dentistes," like two dentists, which to me doesn't really improve on the first guy's joke.
Don't tell a comedian his own joke.
Don't joke the joke.
But how are the dancers? How do they feel about this performance? Were they going along with the composer kind of under duress, or
they do what they're told? Nijinsky is the great genius in ballet. You know, he's kind of the angry young man, and you know, his other work has been a huge hit. I think my guess is if they're anything like young artistic people today, they're excited to be doing something that are pissing off the swells.
Yeah, they can't wait to pee on the American flag.
There's two groups of people in the crowd, as you've kind of hinted. You might see them at Seattle Opera today. There's definitely the people who have all dressed up for this, who are sitting in the boxes. They've got their mink furs, and they've got ostrich feathers coming out of their elaborate hats. And they're there to hear beautiful melodies.
Right, and it's a social event. It's a class reinforcer.
See and be seen.
Yeah.
But then other people are just hardcore fans of this new ballet, and they're the young bohemians wearing their little their little soft hats,
sure,
and bringing their girlfriends in like bandeau kind of dresses.
Right, their shoes have spats. Exactly. Or they don't have spats, even worse.
And it makes them mad that people have paid for the expensive box seats who don't get the ballet.
Oh, I've been to this concert too.
So there's two kinds of people there. Have you ever performed at this concert?
Let's see. You know, I've because my recording career didn't start until I was 32 years old, I never was one of the young punks that was overturning the established musical style.
You were like just doing a Neil Young cover.
Yeah, I was the guy in the middle who was like, I've got indie rock happening for you. But you know, indie rock was
that was weird that you would start with that lyric though. Like
indie rock was rebel. It was quiet as the new loud, right? It was rebelling by being milder.
Exactly.
Which was hard to start a sword fight over.
But it was kind of a, you know, that kind of a new romanticism happens very often. Yeah. I mean, new wave coming out of punk. And it is kind of a, you know what's really badass? Vulnerability and my feelings, bitches.
Yeah, I'm going to turn my guitar down. Take that, mom.
In the crowd, but even among these groups, there's other kinds of geopolitical forces at work. And I think this is kind of what gets to the... So the place is a tinderbox ready to go off because the audience is divided in half and they hate each other.
Right.
And they've already come in knowing that they're going to see these bad boys, Diaghilev and Nijinsky and Stravinsky, and they already have preset opinions.
A lot of skis at the end there. And so it was an immigration crisis as well.
Okay, that's a big issue. There's a lot of anti-Russian sentiment in Paris right now. The Dreyfus Affair has happened, and so you've got this overlapping anti-Semitism with anti-Russian. The idea is that out-of-towners are coming in, and they're polluting the purity of the French arts.
Right.
I mean, then as now, France is a country that really places a lot of value in the uniqueness and the, I don't want to say purity, but the authenticity
right.
of its French artistic heritage.
From a bourgeois.
Right. We invented...
language and culture.
Everything, yeah.
That's what they would have you believe.
We invented cheese and neoclassicism, and, you know, we don't need a bunch of Slavs and Jews coming in here.
Right.
And...
interrupting our glass-blowing classes.
Telling us... yeah, interrupt. Exactly, because that's what would happen. You'd be right in the middle of blowing a beautiful little Christmas ornament of a horse, and suddenly some Jewish fellow would come barging in and just slap you warmly on the back, and
yeah, right. It'd be a Moravian, right? Who understood glass blowing,
Moravian,
but a heretical version.
So if you can kind of imagine the French antipathy to Algerian immigration in the 70s, or what North and West African immigration today, right. You know, you can imagine a Paris that's kind of already set to explode over these issues. And so there's a lot of anti-Russian feeling. And the face of it is Diaghilev coming, setting up shop in this nice theater and being like, we're going to do crazy Russian ballet that doesn't care about your French traditions at all.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of...
mon Dieu.
I mean, he wouldn't say that. He didn't right. He didn't call a press conference.
No. No. He just wore his hat at a jaunty angle, but it communicated so much.
But they had to let him. He had like a P tape of Debussy. So they had to let the Russians mm-hmm. do what they wanted. There's also a lot of anti-Nijinsky feeling because again, he was kind of jerking it on stage during Afternoon of the Fawn. There's a lot of anti-Diaghilev feeling because he's not a purist, you know, he's right. willing to change the music if it makes the steps work, and he's willing to, you know, add new ballet poses even if they're not the traditional ones, you know? And purism is a huge thing in the arts even today.
It is, but what I don't think we have that they did have then was it was connected to morality.
Exactly.
And that this would have been immoral and degenerate and pulling down the youth. I mean, I guess we do have that in terms of every successive wave of hip hop is regarded right. as, you know, even more producing a generation of kids that just want to snort laundry detergent.
I mean, any kind of fan rhetoric will have it today where if people decide that the new Star Wars movie is insufficiently Star Warsy, it really will be like, won't someone think of the children? Like, you know, it will immediately go to 11, even if it's about the stupidest thing.
Boy, those are my people.
You're like, yes, I got to get in on this one. I hate that Weed Guy Boner is saying that the Force and spaceships don't work that way. I need to tell him what the deal is.
You know how I feel about midichlorians.
That's just because you don't have enough. You've got midichlorian envy.
I have so many.
Your midichlorian count is low. Go to your doctor in your yearly checkup and make sure he does a midichlorian count. So yeah, but you're right. Like there today, we wouldn't. Like I was when I was driving here today. A cover song came on the radio. Like it was Devotchka covering that Flying Burrito Brothers song. Hopperito number one or whatever that I'm your toy, I'm your own boy.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a plaintive, simple country thing. And this was much more of a driving beat and like a whole string section. And
did it offend you?
It didn't. No, I did not think this is degenerate art. Like right. In my head, I'm like, do I like this or not? You know, it's like you go to a Shakespeare play and they've decided to update it. And now it's set in the Paris Commune.
Yeah, right.
You think, ooh, what do I think of this choice? But you're right that back then, if Diaghilev takes a Rimsky-Korsakov piece from just a couple decades ago and does some trims, you know, people are really going to be like, he is a bad person.
Yeah,
you know, it's a lot more recent and it seems more fraught to them. So there's a lot of that going on as well, that Diaghilev is the guy that does not respect the purity of the arts. So all this coalesces. And as soon as the stage comes, people are ready to yell, and the curtain comes up, and everybody's wearing
bearskins,
leather jerkins, and they're jerkin instead of doing pliés and jetés and arabesques. And I assume there's some feedback loop where a small group of people start yelling at another
Somebody
group
goes,
of people.
Boots.
I don't know what I think about this.
Harumph, harumph.
And then it just escalates.
Rutabaga, rutabaga.
And the next thing you know, some guy's got a hat pin through his palm.
I mean, sure, because the initial reaction would be, shh, silence. And then they would say, yes, sir, it doesn't deserve my respect. And then, yeah, right, pretty soon, hats are flying.
It's, you know, when I think about these kind of complaints, I went to see a show and the music was too harsh and discordant and didn't respect tradition. And instead of like a nice thing you could dance to, people were just kind of jerking up and down. I mean, it really sounds like complaints about punk to me, you know?
Right.
Like
this, absolutely.
Like this is not beautiful. This is just for people to like, I'm seeing feelings and they're kind of angry, complicated feelings. And that's not what I'm here for.
But it would be like you went to, it would be like a bunch of Crosby, Stills and Nash fans going to like Lilith Fair, and instead you get Skinny Puppy and
Fugazi's opening for Sarah McLachlan at Lilith Fair in 1997 for some reason.
When, and I think it's to do with the monolithicness of culture in 1913. Now if you wanted to hear Sarah McLachlan, you would not go to a Fugazi show. But then there were not that many.
There was one
ballets
kind of music,
to
yeah.
go. To go see.
And I think you're right about context, because just a couple years later, after this whole fiasco, Rite of Spring makes its concert premiere in Paris again, the Casino de Paris, April 5th, 1914.
Divorced from the ballet.
Yeah, no dance. You just go see a conductor, maybe Stravinsky himself, I don't know, like conduct Rite of Spring. And in this case, it's a triumph, and he is literally carried on people's shoulders down the boulevards.
Although somewhat, probably as a reaction to the scandal.
Maybe, I think so, because that's what everybody's going to be thinking. I'm going to a Rite of Spring premiere. Y'all know what happened last time.
Just the way they carried Johnny Rotten on their shoulders down through Whitehall. Then that concludes the Rite of Spring riot. Entry 1076.EZ2613, certificate number 31616, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, there's almost no way you could be scandalized by art anymore. you're like, people in our era, at least, are like pre-scandalized about everything. But the one thing that somehow escapes anyone's attention or emotional connection is art. And I think it's because we're at the end of history. There is no more progress in art. It's just recapitulation of The old ideas, the plié.
Everything you see reminds you of something else, and yes. You can't get mad about something that reminds you of something else.
You're like, oh, this is Tom Petty run through a Prince filter. Like, woohoo. But as soon as...
Wait, I kind of want to hear that. I don't know what album that is, but could you send me that?
As soon as someone says, you know, a single thing about redistricting, boy, look out. The, you know, top hats getting pounded on, sword fights.
That's not funny.
No.
No, redistricting
that's,
is nothing
that's
to...
That's not funny. That's sick.
Ain't nothing to F with.
In our era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are currently being archived at Omnibus Project. And Ken is online being extremely entertaining. Not maybe all the way to like a Jason Isbell level of entertaining, but super, super entertaining.
Jason Isbell's pretty good at Twitter.
He's super good. Yeah, he's a late arrival.
Yeah.
I mean, you were when he was still in short pants, you were making... funnies.
But it's almost amazing that he kind of skipped the boom time of it.
He did.
And like this is his golden age. Yeah. Like he's showing up too late and being like, hey, you guys, we can make jokes on here.
He's being killer. And you wouldn't expect it because he's, you know, a Southern man. And
I expect it.
Southern man.
Not in that way. Not in the Neil Young way. But I expect Southerners to have a wry Cracker Barrel take on affairs.
He's a wonderful person in person.
Do you know him?
I do. I know him and I respect him and I don't know him well enough to say that I love him, but I do cherish him. I'm at John Roderick. I'm none of the above. Not funny, not cherishable.
No, everyone cherishes you.
I'm perishable.
Everyone cherishes your Instagram. Instagram is, Snapchat is perishable. Instagram is cherishable.
Come to Instagram and meet me there. Meet me in old Instagram.
And New Year's Eve at the stroke of midnight, I want you to meet John on Instagram.
On Instagram in 2020, and that will be when I know that we're truly in love. I'm at John Roderick there. You can email us, and please do, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. We are beginning a Patreon-only level of Omnibus, which is one episode a month where we address all your criticisms and addenda to our show. So we will go through, read your letters.
We give you the stage. You get to talk back.
That's right. You tell us how we pronounced Chillicothe wrong.
You just did it wrong again.
Or whatever, you know, Van Huisenbergstein.
You know what I got yesterday?
What?
It's not Swedenborgian. It's Swedenborgian.
Yeah, Swedenborgian.
I am never Borgian. Saying... let me tell you right now. I am never going to say Swedenborgian.
Borgian.
If you have like bangs like a sheepdog, are you sheepdogian?
Swedenborgian.
Swedenborgesque.
No, this is precisely the kind of conversation, although see, better.
You know, this is exactly what the bonus episodes are like.
We will have regarding your letter. So if you have anything you'd like to say, if you want to suggest a show, or yell at us, or praise us. We prefer the praise. At least I do. Ken gets off on a little bit of frisson. Little conflict.
A little tension.
Yeah. Whereas I just like to have my hair petted and someone tell me that it's all okay.
Omnibus remains a free, let me be clear, remains a free public service project for the people of all eras.
True. This is simply an addenda.
If you want a monthly bonus episode, Patreon is the way to secure your access to that.
And on that note, so you're emailing us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and you will hear the results if you contribute to patreon.com/omnibusproject, and that will it's its own reward first of all, but now we have an additional reward, and other levels of reward will be rolling out shortly.
Maybe already have by the time you listen to this.
Who knows?
The time paradox and the grammatical tenses get very tricky.
That's right. Time is a flat circle, and you are somewhere on it, and so are we.
It's like speed skating. It's a flat circle.
You're just and you're rooting for the plot of figure skating or of speed skating.
I don't know how it's going to come out.
Who is the villain here? Please go to. I cannot say please go to Facebook. I want you to delete your Facebook. But if you are on Facebook, and honestly, there's only one reason to be on Facebook, which is to visit the Omnibus Futurelings page, the fans there. Until the Futurelings become themselves a single sentient organism and develop a place on the internet where they are they are free from Facebookian oversight, overlording. Overlordish.
And that's what we guarantee. Logian. That's what we guarantee. There will be no Zuckerbergian infiltration into our little futurelings pocket.
Right. Also on Reddit, which is a version of like a non-Facebook universe, it's just a version of it that's full of people that believe that there's a civilization under the North Pole. And
yeah, that's why Reddit was founded.
The time is a round circle. But go to Reddit.
Like, if you like FARC, but you don't think they talk enough about the Hollow Earth, we need a new site for that.
Also, you can mail us things, and we will talk about these things also on the Patreon show. Mail us physical items at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
I have here a postcard of an old vintage postcard of an old KLM Royal Dutch Airlines Constellation
aeroplane. Oh, it's such a beautiful aircraft. Look at that.
It really is. And the note just says, hey guys, thought you'd enjoy this old plane and the KLM heraldry. And sure enough, we do enjoy the KLM.
I do very much.
Isn't this amazing what we've created? Like, this is the thing I wanted most in my life, for people just to send me postcards of beautiful old airplanes.
My daughter asked me the other day, why does KLM represent Royal Dutch Airlines? And I said, that's a wonderful question for an eight-year-old. I don't speak Dutch, however, sweetie.
Does it stand for the Dutch for Royal Dutch Airways?
Royal Dutch Airways.
It's like Coil Lutch Merlines?
I mean, I assume L is Luft.
Oh,
because yeah, it's a Germanic
and
language.
K could be like Koenig. Or
yeah, right, Koenig. Koenig. Yeah. Koenig Luft Macchiato.
We speak perfect Dutch. This is just an aside, but I was standing in a TSA line a couple weeks ago with these people speaking a very thick European something, but it seemed like it was with an American accent.
Yeah.
And I was like, who are these people? And I finally thought I'd realized, oh, because I could pick out words. Occasionally they'd say passport or whatever. And finally I was like, these people are Dutch, I bet. They're speaking a European tongue in an American accent. I bet they're Dutch. And then I listened to them for a few more minutes and I realized they were Irish. They were speaking English with a very thick Irish accent. And I had gotten it totally wrong.
So I had this experience just the other day. I interviewed the woman Megan Phelps Roper, who was one of the members of the Westboro Baptist Church, mm-hmm. and famously on Twitter, somebody that was supporting
mixing it up
Westboro. And then she started talking to people in DMs on Twitter who she would single out people that would say kind of interesting things to countering her Twitter online, you know, like, well, I'm not so sure that God does want us to protest soldiers' funerals because of like gay life. But anyway, and so she would DM these people and I was one of them. And she and I carried on a DM conversation for a lot of that period. And then she lost her faith and left the church.
You were back-channeling people you helped her defect, basically. You got her out of East Germany.
I was one of a small group of people she was intrigued enough by to talk to that eventually she started to share her doubts about the life that she was born into. Anyway, I interviewed her because she has a memoir called Unfollow. And I was interviewing her at the bookstore, the university bookstore. And then we started taking questions from the audience. And a woman stood up and asked a question. And she clearly was French. She was... Normally, I don't say... I listen to somebody for 15 seconds and say, oh, well, you're French. So, you know, because accents are tricky.
Yeah.
But in this case, she was so clearly French that I was like, well, you know, it's an interesting question. And as a French person, you probably know that. And I made some, you know, generalization. And she said, I'm Bulgarian.
Oh.
And I was like, you are not Bulgarian. So, but I didn't say that to her. Right? I was like, I apologize for misgendering your accent. But then
Bulgarian's not a gender.
But then after
the two genders, Bulgarian and French.
Afterwards, I went up to talk to her and I was like, I'm very surprised that I didn't get your Bulgarian accent. It seems like, you know, it's one that I am familiar with. And she talked to me for a while and I realized this is not a Bulgarian accent. She's speaking a Bulgarian accent with an Irish brogue.
Because that's who her English teacher was?
Yeah. She said, well, when I left Bulgaria, I moved to Ireland and I learned English there. And then you could hear it. You could hear the whole lilt
That's fantastic.
But with a Slavic, you know, like bass note. And I was like, well, I should be, I mean, I still apologize, but I feel like I have a footnote here.
She learned English from Lucky Charms commercials. I don't usually, are you done with your, part of the outro?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I don't usually do this, but one little postscript of our Rite of Spring story that I didn't get to.
Oh, you're going
to
do this now instead of in our special show.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, go ahead.
It's just like a 30-second PS that like works as a postscript. Nijinsky and Diaghilev, this is kind of what happened in the aftermath. Nijinsky and Diaghilev had been having a romance for quite some time that was cementing the company together. But then Nijinsky decided he was going to marry a woman.
Oh.
And Diaghilev was furious, kicked him out of the ballet Russe. And it's a sad story. Nijinsky had a few ballet failures on his own and had a breakdown and spent the next 30 years in mental institutions.
Oh, dear. You know, bisexuality continues to be a controversial orientation, even among alternative nation.
I think
it hurts a lot of people.
Sergei Diaghilev was the original biphobic ballet impresario. We can say that for a fact. Mm-hmm. Stravinsky had been told he went on to great things and lived for like decades more. He lived into the 40s and maybe even the 50s. I bet he died in the 40s, but he was like 88 when he died. He had been told that Rite of Spring was 30 years ahead of his time, and he firmly believed it. People were saying this is what music will be in 30 years, and almost exactly 30 years after Rite of Spring was written, Walt Disney used Rite of Spring in Fantasia to illustrate a thing about dinosaurs and the prehistory of the Earth.
Fantasia really freaked me out as a 7-year-old. So
it worked.
I'm only 2 kisses away from this experience.
Well, it turned out that the critics were exactly right. Like Disney put it right up there alongside Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and right before a ballet piece, I think even.
But it was really Bing Crosby that was shooting up the charts at the time.
That's right. Yeah. But you know, Stravinsky was now part of the musical canon. I think he was not thrilled about having dinosaurs illustrate his work about pagan Slavs, but he kept it to himself. I'm sure the royalty checks cleared. Listeners, speaking to you from our distant prehistoric past, we are like the dinosaurs to you, dying slowly in the mire to the tunes of Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps. From this vantage point, we have no idea how long our civilization will survive before the comet takes us out and replaces us with whatever the equivalent of tiny mammals are. We hope and pray that this catastrophe may never come, but if the disaster we fear comes soon, then this very recording may be our final word, and we will never get to Nicholas Roerich and how he almost brought down FDR's vice president. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.